Hello, everyone, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on June the 21st of 2018. I am Nick. This is Chris. How you doing, everyone?
Yeah. Well, you didn't ask it to me, so I guess I'll just quietly sit here to the side.
Yeah. Unless no, you're on the questioning side with me currently.
Okay. Like, hey, how's everybody doing?
Yeah. We're your hosts. Tell us, everyone. Yes, and we can hear you right now. We're listening intently.
Wait, we can hear everybody who's listening.
Ooh, oh, my. Oh, God. Oh. Oh.
You should definitely call the police. And you need to call a chiropractor. And you need to call Marvel and let them know that you have a great movie idea. Those are the three things I heard. Nick, I want to set up a new segment on our show. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we start off with like a weird anecdote, but then sometimes we don't have one. So I wanted to start off with a way that kind of makes us a little bit more connected with like the kids today, because we're trying to always appeal to the younger kids. So I think.
Hang on. Let me do this right. Lee. Position the chair backwards.
Yeah, so we're ready to wrap up the kids today. So I'm just going to take a trending topic, and we're just going to start talking about it. And I don't know anything about the World Cup, so I'm just taking all those out. So instead, we're going to talk about the hashtag remake The Last Jedi, which if you aren't aware of what this is, it's a bunch of people who are very butthurt about the fact that they didn't like the way The Last Jedi went, and they're actually trying to put together the movie, or the money rather, and support to make an actual filmed remake of The Last Jedi that would go into theaters and erase the last one from canon.
They claim they're serious, but some of the things that they're saying don't seem to logically make sense. So, I don't know. It could very well just be a masterstroke of a troll, because
it very likely could. It very likely
You never know on the internet.
What would be the best remake of The Last Jedi we could expect? Knowing full well the sorts of people who dislike the current movie, most notably like the people who are so angry they harassed like two different actresses off of Instagram and everything else like that. What kind of movie would it be? And we already know there's the men's right activist cut of the movie, which removes
like 40 minutes long. Yeah.
Which removes everything and somehow tells a cohesive story. But what would the
it's Kylo Ren very, very closely cropped from the neck up having a conversation with nobody.
He's just shirtless talking to nothing. That's just every shot they use of him in the movie is him shirtless talking to nothingness whatsoever.
Oh, no, they made him even hotter.
They made him thicker. They just extend his body out to it's like the size of the screen with his pecs alone. I would say it'd be 98% Mark Hamill, because that's all everybody really wants is like the old characters back. So it's like Mark Hamill, but he's also Han Solo. Like he does both sides of it. So he hangs out with Chewie. And I don't know, maybe they don't want to give R2-D2 a voice, but they definitely want to substantially increase his character. So they replace Holdo with R2-D2.
All of her dramatic twists and turns are replaced with R2-D2 going beep boop.
Yeah, it's just Poe screaming like, why won't you tell this man? And it just scrolls off the screen.
Don't you take that turn with me, Commander.
It's him like being held back from like punching it. It's just like they also replace Leia with R2-D2 as well, so we get the space scene of like R2-D2 floating off into space, and then it just starts rolling forward, but it has no appendages to lift forward, so it's literally just like a string with an R2-D2 at the end of it rolling across space, which I'll admit actually better than the real scene, but still.
Which and it makes a happy R2 noise when it happens.
Yeah.
While flying through space surrounded by corpses.
You know what? Guys, let me be honest. Sure. Remake of Last Jedi should just be 90% parts played by R2-D2, and the other 10% are just the roles that are humorously there to bounce off of R2-D2. So, like, Poe being angry at R2-D2 could still be there. Like, Yoda being angry at R2-D2 could still be there. Everyone else, though, is just an R2-D2 for some reason.
I think that the best version of a remake of The Last Jedi that we can make will be a confused mess, because let's face it, people who aren't happy with the new Star Wars movies are fans who literally don't know what they want. They just know what they don't want. So when they try and actually coherently make something and put it together based off of a script written by committee, it's just going to be a stream of consciousness thing that makes no sense when you tie it together. It's a collection of parts that don't fit together because it's written by like 10 different angry nerds who don't know what they want. They just know that they don't like Rey. and Rose.
Are people still angry about Rey? I thought that was over at this point. I thought
it's not over. There's a clip that's going around now of a guy who like ripped apart a Rey action.
Oh yeah, I've seen that. That's like that's just sad. That's why I'm very glad that like I grew up at just enough of a point that when I was in my shitty, angsty teenage years, the internet didn't exist. So my like thoughts of being like highly aggressive or just like feeling like you knew everything about the fucking world doesn't exist online anymore. You know, like there's no way to find most of those things. Not like Kamen, who I have a picture of him photoshopped as a Navi that I'm keeping forever. But, you know, like the cringiest stuff's mostly gone.
I mean, it's so I get the feeling like they would basically start off.
Oh, no.
Establishing the we disconnect briefly.
Yeah, you're good.
Okay. We would start off by establishing that Finn actually is the last Jedi or whatever. He actually is super force sensitive, and he's going to be a stormtrooper lightsaber wielding awesome guy. But he's played by a white guy now for some reason.
I was gonna say, you know, this actually is something I'm totally on board with everything you're talking about right now. I definitely am on board with John Boyega super Jedi, like. Trust me, I have no problem with that.
He's no longer in love with Rey because that would make him pussy whipped. Instead, he's super macho badass. And Poe and Rey are a romantic couple now. And Rey is dressed like I don't know, like you know that character in Jumanji.
Karen Gillian,
yeah, Not that kind of character, but dressed like that kind of character.
Okay, you know? So in Jumanji, they point out that it's like a stereotype of like sexist video game character design.
Right, right.
And but it's just played straight.
Because that story is actually surprising in its portrayal of female characters, despite the fact that they had Karen Gillian dressed that way. But they play around with it. No, it's just like she dresses like that and she's completely helpless. And Poe is like saves half the movie, saving her from various different situations involved, including, of course, one where she gets dressed even more skimpy so they can do like slave labor, you know. Kylo Ren just goes back to wearing the mask and he doesn't whine about his past at all. And Luke is somehow his father and his uncle, despite the fact that Han Solo was his father, you know. So
also Admiral Akbar.
Also Akbar does all the Holdo parts. and half of the movie is literally just I've even forgotten his name. I don't even care. Kylo Ren's master just explaining himself and explaining his backstory and explaining.
He's like, long ago, I was a young man who was trained by someone you may have heard of.
This is every question that went unanswered in the Rio version.
That
made the movie boring as shit if you had heard it, because I'm not actually supposed to be important. That was the point. Also, it's revealed who Rey's parents are, but then it's quickly just shoved to the side because she's not important, and then she, you know, washes a car while wearing a bikini.
You know what? This new version is actually, for the sheer amount of stupidity of it, is starting to win me over now. I'm like, why is there a car wash in space? But let's go for it. This intrigued me. I've always been interested in the bikini car wash Star Wars universe crossover event, and now we have it, so I'm pretty pumped about that.
And everyone talks about how much they hate some random girl named Rey, even though she never appears on screen. They just talk about how much they hate her and what a loser she is. And there you go.
Exactly.
All right, so now with that fixed...
we've saved Star Wars.
I hope that nobody tries to edit this conversation and recontextualize it so that I sound remotely serious. Oh, man.
It's tough nowadays to tell what's parody and what's not, honestly.
Exactly. Like I said, I was
real
just
life
saying,
has become very confusing.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing. It's like, satire is dead. And like I said, I don't even know if the real version of that movement is actually real or not. So, anyway. All right. Now that we're done talking with the kids, let me actually sit comfortably in this chair.
Like an hour later, you just fall over. Ah, damn kids!
Ah, my crotch!
Damn the children!
All right, let's do our manga recap, Chris.
Yes. Let's proceed through the regular chapters in a brisk, orderly pace so that we can then spend the remaining, presumably, hour to hour and a half discussing this week's One Piece.
Yeah, well, because we've got to answer all the unanswered questions about Snoke.
Yep, exactly.
Let's begin with My Hero Academia number 187, Flaming Roar versus Nomu, High End. It's too extreme
of a chapter title.
Flaming Roar! All right. So, it leaves off from the previous chapter where we had Endeavor fighting the new High End Nomu, which has suddenly attacked himself and Hawks. But before we get to that, we actually get a glimpse at Endeavor's family outside of Shoto Todoroki. And we're introduced to two of Todoroki's older siblings. It was actually something that I didn't realize, which was that Todoroki actually has a brother. I thought that they said at some point that he only had sisters, but I guess I was wrong.
No, I thought it was that he had multiple siblings, but that none of them were what he was intending to do. Like, none of them ended up being as powerful as Endeavor wanted them, so that he just discarded all of them. I don't know if they were ever specifically saying the number or amount of either brothers or sisters or anything.
So they are visiting Todoroki's mother in her care facility. It's a hospital, let's call it that, I guess. I think it's like supposed to be a mental health ward or something like that, because she, you know, lost it and boiled her son's face. But anyway. So they're, you know, just talking casually about various things and while they visit her. And Todoroki's mom holds up a bunch of letters that he sent her because he hasn't had as many chances to visit with the dorm situation and his license training stuff. And saying, well, that's sweet that he actually did keep in contact with her after visiting her the one time and stuff. Natsuo, the brother, brings up, hey, they made him the number one hero yesterday. And nobody actually knows the truth about you, about all of us as siblings, and about how he's treated his family. And he doesn't, really talk about himself very much anyway. And he basically says, he discarded us. He was like this perfect stranger, but, that's not as bad as what he did to you, what he did to Shoto. And I just can't, let people pretend that didn't happen. And I think that he's just trying to leave all that behind him without actually trying to do anything about it. But his mother says that's not actually true, and she points out that there are flowers that were left for her by Endeavor, and she says that I told him that they were my favorite, and I only told him once the day that we met. So he's apparently come to this many times. I've never actually seen him, and the doctors recommended that I not actually see him. And I can't say what he's thinking. It might be external pressures, but he's not leaving anything behind. Not his past, not his family. I know he's trying to make sense of it all.
So, this is an interesting way of doing this. We've mentioned before that Endeavor's redemption is always going to be a very, very touchy subject, because people are going to have very different interpretations of whether or not this character should have a redemption, whether or not redemption is something they can actually have, etc. I will say that in the interest of trying to redeem Endeavor, I think this is a mighty important step and execution to actually carrying that across. Because I think if they try to ignore what he did, then it would always feel hollow.
Mm-hmm.
But by actually showing that he's acknowledging what he's done shitty in life, and they show that not only is it not, it's not just like fixed once, like they say that he keeps going, he's never actually seen her because they say it wouldn't be healthy for them, but he's acknowledging that he's been fucking an awful person for most of his life. It's an interesting way to portray it, because it feels genuine in the notion of like, this is a changed man kind of attitude. Again, there's tons of people out there, and there's never going to be a right answer to this sort of scenario, but as somebody who is on, I guess, the side of saying, like, I believe in redemption for people, for Endeavor's situation here, this feels like a good step to showcase. You know, it's not about him just punching Nomu the super strongest way. It's about showing that he's made mistakes and he needs to make amends for them.
It's going to be a touchy thing, and I think that this is going to be something that is going to be much more difficult to address than, like, why is Mineta a character? He's a 15-year-old pervert, you know, whatever. And what about Baku? I was like, well, that's a bit more difficult because, yes, he is kind of an asshole and a bully, but they are showing that he is changing and maturing. And when you're that age, you know, he's made mistakes and is not a complete person yet and could potentially come out much better for it. Endeavor was abusing his family for most of his adult life. And now all of a sudden the situation that he's in has changed and he's trying to make amends. And that's going to be very difficult to do. But it's important that he at least try. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're never going to be able to see him as anything other than antagonistic force, which it seems as though the series does not want to take that direction with him at this point. So I don't know if, you know, people are going to have, I don't know how this story is going to, what direction this is going to take, and I don't think that we're even going to be able to pass judgment on it for some time. But we'll see how it goes.
Yep.
Anyway, there's a fight going on. The High End Nomu and Endeavor fight through most of the rest of the chapter. He, of course, hit it with this big flame fist thing in the previous chapter, but it quickly regenerates from that. And shrugs off the damage. And it never quickly analyzes that this thing is, like, on another level from any of the Nomu that have appeared up to this point, because it can talk and it's absorbing damage much more effectively than others. But he realizes that there's an opportunity in the fact that it can talk. He's like, oh, well, I'm going to take you in alive and, you know, make you cough up information that you know of. But right after that, the Nomu attacks him and smashes him into the building and just starts raking him across it. It beats him up pretty badly. Honestly, I'm surprised that he escapes this with as little damage as he does, because I don't recall any point that says that he has some sort of damage absorption ability. I don't know, maybe his flames protect him somehow. This messes up the building, of course, because the Nomu just rips through, like, half of it, causes structural damage. So it's up to Hawks to use his ability to try and do damage control. He sends out his feathers to snag people who are in danger away from the building and carry them to safety. And we get a full explanation of his quirk, which is Fierce Wings. And he is able to manipulate every single feather that he sends out individually.
You know what I love about this? Is that somewhere on the superhero powers Wikipedia page or whatever, they have to add a new entry for feather kinesis just for this one motherfucker. I'm lying. They probably have one already set up for that.
And that's basically it. That's the chapter. Two very different parts, and one goes by much more quickly than the other, because the fight scene is basically all one moment of Endeavor getting dragged through a building for several pages. So
a couple things I want to note. One thing is I really like the way they are showing Endeavor's powers, because it seems to be pretty innovative. That's generally how I can gauge, like, how a series is interesting me, is like the way they make powers interesting. And he's not just, like, punching fire in a bigger blast each time, like, say, like Natsu did. Like, he actually shows he has specific fire techniques, like the threads that he's creating and the idea of, like, kind of boosting himself into the air, but he's like, I'm just gonna keep falling eventually. He only has a limited amount, which is pretty dope. But I also, it's very, and I wonder if maybe this is a discussion that reached Japan, of like, it feels like a very Man of Steel-esque conversation happening right now, where they're just like, oh, this fight's going to knock over this building and kill hundreds of people. We should really try to stop that and help that as much as humanly possible. I don't know. It's definitely an interesting sort of thing to see that. And I guess this makes a little bit more sense as to why Hawks is a number two hero, because if his power was just to fly back, this dude has to be like a fucking like marine badass in his like regular abilities to be number two with a power that's just like, I fly. So I'm pretty interested to see how this fight goes. I think it was kind of cool to get more from Endeavor and to explore this character a little bit more. We're now, what, like three chapters in a row without any of the regular principal cast, so it's kind of cool seeing that My Hero is a series strong enough to sustain itself without needing to be like, here's Bakugo, all my Deku, here, just take him, it's fine. So I like this chapter quite a lot.
Okay. Yeah. Let's, I'm looking forward to seeing how this fight plays out. But I was pleasantly surprised to get that bit at the beginning, too. All right. Let's move on to Food Wars. Oh, my gosh. There's so much goofy shit about this chapter. I'm sorry. All right. It's Food Wars chapter something. Chapter 267, Soma and Megumi's Hot Springs Case Files, File 03, Les Cuisiniers Noirs. I don't speak French. So we get more of the conversation going on between Irina and Hisako, which apparently they just like, Hisako just like finds a chance to like ask her about this every now and then. Like she goes off and does some more stuff and then comes back 8 hours later. By the way, about that mission Soma and Megumi are on, I have more questions about this. And she brings up a salient point, which is, hey, so if there are, like, people disappearing and places being randomly shut down, shouldn't the police be getting involved? What's this have to do with the Council of Ten? And Arya says, if this were merely a disappearance case. But it isn't. So it cuts back to where Soma and Megumi are. And, they have just heard a brouhaha coming from the kitchen. Go inside and find that the lady of the bathhouse is of the onsen rather is unconscious. She's collapsed, and the chef is like, "It's my fault for not being good enough." And he's holding his arm as if it's just been broken, and he's. It was such a shock. This guest barged into our kitchen and challenged me to a shokugeki. And it's the American dude bro from the previous chapter, but he's got his baseball cap off and he's lowering his face so that he looks all evil and he's smirking. He looks exactly like that. Like it's like he's trying to look evil, but he's just such a dude bro that he can't pull it off. So was like, ah, so you're the one behind all these incidents. Why a shokugeki? Just who are you? And what are you after? That's easy, bro. He, like, goes on this long, chapter-long rant about his evilness, but not forgetting that he's this weird surfer dude the whole way through.
He's like, so, bruh, it's like, fucking the food in Japan is so garbage, and the inn doesn't treat you like you're a prince like they should. And it's like, whoa, man, come on now. Give me some daps, like, for reals. Like, don't they know who I am? Back home, my dad owns the dealership. Not a dealership, the dealership.
Oh, man. So,
why don't the heroes take me seriously, brah?
So, he says, from now on, you're going to cook exactly what I tell you to cook and exactly how I tell you to. And only then will this dinky inn provide good hospitality in all the ways it's supposed to, bro. And both Megumi and Soma are like, no, that's ridiculous. Come on, you can't just do that. It's like, oh, come on, bro, it's Japan, and you've got the best system ever invented, the shokugeki. So basically, he is using the shokugeki to get what he wants in this case after he has learned about it, which shocks Megumi because she's like, he doesn't seem like he graduated from Tadakor Institute, so how the hell does he even know about that? That's when they go over to the dish that he actually made for the Shokugeki, which is lobster, foie gras, and caviar. Now, you don't need to know what that tastes like, which I don't, to know that it's super expensive.
Like, lobster sounds expensive already.
And the caviar
reminds me of a shitty fucking Simpsons joke, one that I enjoy, where Mo gets money, or he goes to a restaurant, he's like, give me your finest food stuff with your second finest food. And I'm like, absolutely, sir. Lobster stuffed with tacos. And like, they show it later, just a lobster with like taco meat falling out of it.
What the fuck kind of place serves tacos and lobster?
I always love that notion.
The Taco Bell seaside restaurant. Oh, man. And I love that the chef, you know, brings up, this isn't just that his dish had hoity-toity ingredients merely for the sake of it. He's actually a top shelf chef, too. And the dude's like, well, duh. See, I don't just use the most gorgeous of ingredients. I've got mad gorgeous skills to go with. Skills spelled with an S-K-I-L-L-Z. So you know he's for real about this. Mod skills, what is the deal? So he throws up some of the almaz caviar, toss it into the air, and holding a chef's knife in the most uncomfortable position to perform this feat of skill with, slices and dices them through the air. I understand that that's the way you actually want to chop ingredients when you're a chef, is to, you know, hold the knife very steadily so that you can rapidly dice through it. I have no idea how he can flick the blade through the air like that while holding it in that way. It's so uncomfortable to me. But he also does it perfectly and slices these 3 millimeter eggs in half perfectly in midair. So he's super good and awesome. And he then says, you want to try a bite, Mr. Mad Skills Kid and Miss Yamato Nadeshiko? Which, that's such a bizarre sentence right there. Such a sequence of phrases. So Soma is freaked out by this, but the real weird one is Megumi, who's like, it's unbelievably delicious, like an unstoppable wave. I can't resist as it envelops me, drowning in the lap of luxury, feeling like a king. Which she imagines as if she's in a bathtub filled with money, with bills covering her nipples, while her harem girls surround her, counting her money with her. It's such a bizarre one, and even Megumi afterwards is like, what the fuck did I just imagine?
It's like, I don't even know how I went there.
I just found out some things about myself, my guy. Apparently I want to be a drug kingpin. First the money, then the women.
Then I believe it only gets better from there. I've never finished Scarface. He just gets to end the movie happy, right? He gets all the money and the women in power.
Oh, God. So the lady of the house is like, and we stood no chance. And my one bite, my whole bite was capitulated. A dish with all those rare expensive ingredients in front of us. There is no way we could beat it. And then we quietly cut back to the conversation between Aaron and Hisako. Hisako's having some tea. And she says, you could call them chefs of the underworld. They live and cook in the dark corners of the culinary world. Say, for example, that the rich and powerful of the world meet in secret over a business dinner to discuss matters that could never be made public, or that a crime lord chooses to hold some sort of grand but illegal entertainment, or a drug lord decides that she wants to bathe with other women in her money bathtub and also wants to have food at the same time. Shut up. I've been reading some weird manga lately. There are all sorts of occasions where the wealthy and influential cannot afford to hire a typical chef. In recent times, the demand for chefs with the correct profile to serve those sorts of events has seen a sudden rise. And for certain members of the culinary world, such as Bon and Coyote Blades in their cooking contest against evil sabotage twins cooks. Never forget the best story arc of Bambino. Coyote Blades. This is a golden opportunity for audacious scoundrels cast out from polite society who cook solely to satisfy their own arrogant whims. Immoral chefs so dedicated to honing their craft, they're willing to break the law to do so. Chefs like those have withdrawn from the everyday culinary world, choosing instead to reap their profit in the underworld. We call these chefs Les Cuisiniers Noirs, the Dark Chefs! Chefs of Darkness, Chris! We've entered Shokugeki no Soma, Kingdom Hearts Edition.
This makes far too much sense to be a Kingdom Hearts plotline. The characters haven't questioned whether or not they're dreaming yet. I mean, come on. So this is insanely stupid and great, because that's when Food Wars is at its best, when it's as dumb as humanly possible.
You guys thought that Food Wars was ruined forever. No. Dark Chefs.
Because, like, it's such a stupid concept, too. Because you're like, okay, with Tatsuki Institute, it made sense. Shokugekis were, like, the law that passed down to school. They were like, hey, you're all rocks ground together. Diamonds will pop out. So you're constantly thrown against one another. And, like, the rules of the school say Shokugeki law is final. So if you lose, like, the school would see to it that it happens. This way, they're just like... We do it in real life. I'm like, well, who's to say if you beat me? And you're like, well, if I win, I get your gun. I'm like, I'm just going to shoot you. Like, who's to say this doesn't follow? This is to follow the honor of the black cuisiners?
When darkness overlaps with darkness, the gates of the underworld will be thrown open into the world of true gourmet. This is so dumb. I love it. And Izaku's reaction to all of this ridiculous news is, gosh!
Golly gee!
So, Arina confirms that she believes that there is a chance that these ruffians, Les Cuisiniers Noirs, have learned about the Shokugeki, and I cannot allow that to stand. The Shokugeki system is the pride of the Totsuki Institute. These invaders seek to abuse our system so they can manipulate this country to their whims, but I will see every one of them brought to justice. Which, okay, at least that's a very solid explanation as to why someone maybe were sent out to handle this. And also, a good setup and move into how this is going to be Totsuki Institute having international conflicts if the chefs of all of the underworld and on Earth are going to gather on Japan to try and manipulate it to their own ends, using Japan's system to their own means. That's like, okay, that makes some amount of sense. It's stupid, but internally the logic is consistent.
Yes. So I will say that...
The chapter's not over yet, but go ahead.
Okay. I'll just say, I can understand hesitance to maybe jump on board with this, because although Food Wars is at its best, it's been really stupid, it sort of lost a little bit of that faith by continuing, like, with the whole Azami thing, where he started off as this stupidly evil person in a cooking manga, and then eventually kind of lost that towards the end. So I think, depending on how this series takes itself, like this arc, this could be a brilliant idea, or this could be fucking horrifying. So I will understand that why there may be some hesitancy in jumping on board with this new arc.
So the dude says, his name's been mentioned so little I've completely forgotten. But anyway, so... he actually makes a good point, which is like, you know, you guys have got it easy. Where I work, if you present some dish that ruins the dinner, or even if the guest simply doesn't love your food, nobody blinked twice if you were executed on the spot. Compared to that, this Hokugeki thing is a total walk in the park. I love that he calls it a Hokugeki. It's like the easiest dumb thing to call it. So he's like, you know, it's not like I'll die if I lose, so no pressure on me. And so he's like, so I'll just take over this country's ends and teach them the true meaning of good hospitality. And at that moment, Megumi is like, hey, I think you've got the wrong idea about what real hospitality is. And that's where the chapter ends. It's like, oh my god, is this actually going to happen, or is she going to give a speech and then step aside for someone to handle this shit? Because if she actually steps the fuck up and is like, this is why I'm on the Council of Ten now, bitches, I'm on board with this. But I still have to say, like, it still might be Soma who does this, though.
I'd have to hope that we get something out of Megumi. It does feel like it's almost insulting for her to get on the Council of Ten, and we still haven't seen her actually win a Shokugeki in, like, 4 years now or so. Like, it's been a while since she's actually won any Shokugeki she's been a part of.
I don't think that she's actually... I don't think we've ever actually seen her win a direct one-on-one Shokugeki. Oh. I think that the only thing that we saw was the during the Fall Classic, she was, you know, in the top ranked in her block.
Let's see. Oh, there's a Megumi Todoroki who is a tennis player. So,
well, you're looking for Megumi Tadokoro, not Megumi Todoroki.
There we go. All right, let's see. The wiki has to have a list of her.
I'm sure.
Shokugekis, right?
Any proper wiki that is based on follows a series that is based on regular competitions will have a list of battles and duels and stuff.
She won against Oh wait, hold on. I think this might be the current one actually. She lost against Kurikiba. She lost against Momo. She drew against Shinomiya, and she drew against I've never even heard of Takumi and the Aldini brothers.
That might be a filler thing.
Yeah, that might be a filler arc. So she's never actually won an on-screen duel of any kind. So
there you go.
Oh no, wait. Shikimichi Kumai. Now, he was one of the guys. This must have been another anime filler thing, because he was one of, like, the four random people that they had during, like, the start of all the zombies taking over, and they're having these big show. Remember, we got like the random people.
Yeah, with Hulk guy.
Yeah, I think that was the Hulk guy. So apparently, she beat him. But yeah, other than that, she's lost every lost or drawn in every on screen appearance she's been in, it seems like.
So there you go. All right, let's move on from here to Dr. Stone Z=62 Double Chase. We begin, of course, with the plan that Senku sent in motion to set off explosions to distract Homura so that she would not follow Chrome and Gin and Magma as they tried to use their cell phone plan. Homura rushes to the village to investigate. Kohaku, when Suika sees her approaching, goes after her. And I don't know how the hell this actually physically makes sense, because we see one panel where Homura is like perched in a tree or something. Kohaku comes up behind her, attacking her with the blunt edge of her blade, swinging for the back of her neck. And the very next panel, we see that not only has Homura like backflipped over the blade, but she's also twisted over it. So she's managed to do like a full 180 degree turn on two different axes of her body in the blink of an eye. So she dodges the blade and then just vaults through the air, flipping between branches and stuff to get away. Karaka's like, what the hell? How did she do that? And Mura's like, I've taken gymnastics. Not that you know.
I like that there's just like, how did she pull out these roots? I'm a gymnast. That's it. Like, they cut to it one more time in the chapter, but it's just like, okay. Not like a big reveal or anything like that. It's like a small panel that if you really have like bad eyesight or you haven't seen gymnastics before, you may not entirely know what she means.
They also have each woman briefly observe that they're pretty evenly matched. So Homura is not pulling away, but she's also not close to getting caught either. So they're like, all right, I'll chase her towards the village so that we can surround her and grab everyone. Then rushing along the ground between the trees after them comes Senku, who's got something in his hand that he's preparing to toss up. And I really love the image of him preparing to throw it. It's just a really cool dynamic pose that he's in with his arm, with his hand sticking out and everything the wire unraveling around his fingers and stuff. I really like the way it looks. He throws it up and he explains as it's flying through the air that he has made a flash grenade, and there's a brief little explanation of how you can make a flash grenade. Blind your friends! And he sets it off, and Himuri, of course, is stunned. It also blinds the other people present, of course, except for him, because he made sure to, cover his fucking eyes like you would. And while Himuri is distracted, he tackles her to the ground, and they're like, "All right, yeah, Senku, he's really physically weak, but he managed to do it. Good job, yeah, all right, Senku." There's a weird little exchange between Himura and Senku, because she's like, "Watch where you're touching me," and he's like, "You're not gonna be able to pull that on me. I am basically asexual."
He's like, "I'm in love with science."
I like how though he's like, "Once our scientific civilization's up and running, there'll be plenty of impressionable boys for you to flirt with." And she's like, "Shut up." I like that she, and then she's like, "Oh man, what should I do? Should I try and force him off and run? But I doubt that I'm actually stronger." Huh. And then she just throws him off immediately.
Everyone's just like, "All right, Senku sucks."
So I guess that Senku is not like Hiruma in that he worked really, really hard to improve on his physical limitations.
Nope.
Just relies on his string bean physicality. Himura then quickly dodges to escape, rushes up into the treetops, and everyone's like, "Oh my god, she's gotta get away!" And Kohaku can't chase after her because she's especially sensitive to the flash grenade because of her really good eyesight. So it's like, "Ah, oh, there you go. Keep it consistent with that." And using it as a means for the villain to get one up on the heroes. I like that. When she's up in the trees, Himura looks down at all the people there gathered then. She's like, she starts rattling off names. And, okay, Ginro, Kohaku, Suika, Kakyo, goes through a bunch of ones that whose names we haven't even seen in a while. And then she's eventually like, "We're Chrome, Magma, and Gen, because everyone's here except those three. That's weird. Where are they?" Well, let's see. Chrome has, you know, expertise, and Magma has strength, so I guess they could have gone for war. But no, why would Gen go with them? The only reason he would go with them would be to guide them. So where would he guide them? Oh no. And she immediately, from all that, realizes that they're heading towards the Tsukasa Empire, just like they must be going with some sort of scientific tool to do something, but I don't know what it could be, so I've got to go and stop them. So I do like that it's established here in this, you know, series that's all about, you know, characters being smart and being clever and figuring out innovative ways to do things, that we also have villains who are intelligent, and also intelligent in very different ways. Tsukasa is not the most scientifically gifted mind, but he has this tremendous charisma and minds for strategy and manipulation. And Momura, we see, is like very, very observant, and has a very, really quickly comes to a conclusion based off of the evidence and just on the observations that she's made about the individual villagers. So, cool stuff.
Yeah.
So everyone's like, "Well, shit, what do we do now? Like, she's going to catch them, because there's no way that they can actually travel faster than her. You know, she's not burdened by the cell phone." So, Senka's like, "Don't worry, I've got another scientific gadget." And he holds up this weird kind of flashlight almost looking thing. And marks of light suddenly appear along the ground, leading in a trail. And they're like, "Oh, this shows what route Himura took. And Seka says, "All right, it's time for a chase within a chase." Presumably, he did something to mark her with some sort of, like, radioactive material or something along those lines, something that shows up under a particular light. But
I like the idea that radioactive, like, he just, like, slathered.
"I poisoned you with nuclear radiation."
Like, he just spread plutonium across her back, and she gets, like, halfway there. She's like, "I feel kind of dying."
It's like a radioactive brick from The Simpsons. He stuck to her back. Yeah, cool chapter and a lot of fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I think one of the better parts, as you mentioned, is that, like, it does feel, we only know a couple, like, named characters in Tsukasa's Empire, and it's nice to know that those characters are actually competent. Mm-hmm. So it's not just like, "Well, we made this one scientific invention, that's it." It's like, "Oh, wait, we have to contend with the fact that this character may not know a lot about science, but they're still innately very smart." And that's pretty cool.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to We Never Learn.
Yeah, so let's talk about We Never Learn, question 67. X treads a thorny path as festivities continue. Sure. So this chapter begins, and they were like, all right, Ashumi should be at this. So it turns out...
I was just thinking to myself in the last couple of chapters, like, it's a shame that Asumi's not at this festival. Like, oh, apparently she is, and she can fucking rock.
Yeah, apparently they're like, oh, she's a fucking rock guitarist now. It's like, okay. I don't remember if this was ever hinted at before, but sure, she was apparently a super rock guitarist, and they invited her back to the school during its festival because she's extremely good, and it was cool for do that. She was apparently a former member of the rock club. So there we go. We have all the girls here now. And she's basically like, yeah, study hard, catch you guys later. Passes by Furuhashi in the window, and they see that she's kind of just like getting dragged away. And she's just like, huh, well, I guess that'll work itself out. And then she runs into Yuega. And I do enjoy it because they reveal, I'm sure we heard it before, but this is the first time I noticed it, where she's just like, she sees Yuega in the costume, and she's like, Meowpolian Z, which is like clearly the least amount of effort someone took to make this character's name. They're like, he's a cat, kind of looks like Napoleon, Meowpolian. This is like a Halloween month fucking level pun where I'm just like, Meowpolian. And they make a joke about like how, like, why are you doing this? Like, why are you wearing this weird costume and everything? What are you doing? And he's just like, oh, but I gotta go. She's like, oh, geez, how do you keep getting yourself into these fixes? So we cut away and we cut back to Sumi's butt because we are on the inside of the school air ducts. Which, I'll be honest, like, the whole thing that you generally get with, like,
Are wide air ducts, by the way.
They're wide air ducts.
They've got room to spare.
They got room to spare, but not only that, it fits his giant, stupid cat Napoleon costume very comfortably, to the point where I'm just like, this is crazy.
Not just his giant cat costume, also Asumi's guitar. It's sticking up way over his head. They should not even need to, like, kneel on hands and knees to get through this. They could probably like crouch walk through this. Yeah. It's ridiculous.
So there's basically this moment of Yuega being like, oh man, I'm behind her so I can get this view of her butt, but he's like trying to like turn his attention everywhere else. He's just like, oh, you know, I never knew about this shortcut or anything like that. And she's like, yeah, you know, you can get anywhere through the ducts, you know, I've used these came in handy a lot back when I was at school. And you guys, I'm always like, you know, now that I think about it, I guess she really did go to school here, you know, never really noticed it before. And Shuby points out like, oh, hey, you know, we actually overlapped 2 years in the school and never realized it before. You know, if only we had met sooner, we could have shared more experiences like this. Now, of course, you would have seen me in more compromising positions, so I guess it's just as well. And I'm like, so she knows that he has a great view of her ass right now because she jokes about it in the next panel. What would a more compromising position than that be right now? Like, my only thought is she's just like, I don't know why I thought Nate.
I think she means more numerous, not more scale.
In my mind, she's just like, I don't know why I thought naked heists were a great idea, but I had to smuggle all those hot dogs out in between my legs somehow. And I'm just like, yeah, I guess that would be more compromising, I guess, than this. So they figure out where, like, the exit is, but the two teachers are there. So she distracts him by showing up and basically distract him by being like, oh, I came because I missed my favorite teacher so much. Woo-doo-doo. And, you know, she's so adorable and charming. She basically distracts him as Yuega escapes. Now we cut away to the actual...
Now, before we move on, I have to say something because... I was, the first time I read this, very concerned that she had deliberately tied off her top to bare her midriff when she went to talk to the teachers. I was like, what the fuck is she going for there? But then I was like, okay, flip back. Okay, it was already tied off from the beginning. She did not do it specifically for that purpose. Okay.
So we got over to the actual play. And currently they're at the point where the narrator is talking about, like, they need the prince to wake her up. But Yuega's not there, so what are they possibly going to do? And I want to tangent side this thing here. Nick, did you ever have any school plays that you had to, like, watch when you were in school and it had, like, a situation come up like this?
Oh, where something went horribly wrong?
Not to this extent. So I'll mention real quick, I think it was, like, sixth grade, our school did the Newsies as our play, and there's, like, a scene where one of the characters meets, like, the main female character at the train station. And the one night I went, I guess the actress who was playing the lead female, I don't remember any of the characters' names, I'm sorry, it wasn't that good of a play, I guess got really panicked and nervous and didn't come out, so the dude had to, like, show up at the train station. He's like, man, the train sure is taking long. Should be here any minute. Like, as they were back there, be like, please, for the love of God, go out there.
Any minute now.
He's like, man, trains sure don't run on time like they used to.
Ha 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 ha.
I give him credit because he had to, like, vamp for like a minute and a half before they finally managed to convince her to go out for a queue.
You gotta go do what you gotta do.
Yeah. So they're really panicking because they have no idea how to really stall any longer. And that's when the principal shows up and he just
takes I am a patron of the arts and I shall resolve this problem.
Yeah, he's just like, this is taking too long. Someone from the crowd come up here and be the prince. And all the boys in school were just like, holy shit, yes, this is great. You know, the leader of the...
I'm so horribly repulsive that I could never get a kiss from a cute girl otherwise.
Like, Furuhashi's super admirer comes out and is like, what are you doing? He's just like, well, it's better than just letting the play be ruined because there's no prince, right? And besides, we're not talking about a real kiss. So all the dudes who are coming up are just like, I want to kiss! And we get, like, a super action panel of Furuhashi's, like, super ninja clan just, like, knocking people over with martial arts. And they introduce themselves as members of the...
It's actually super awesome.
Members of the Shaolin Club, the Aikido Club, and the Karate Club, who are just like, we will battle anyone who tries to attack our princess.
We are the Thorny Briars protecting the princess's slumber. You must first pass through us.
So the narrator's super pumped because she's like, all right, I'll just roll with this now. A whole huge horde of princes are attacking the Thorny Briars in wild battle, but who will reach Princess Furuhashi with his kiss? And that's when Yuega shows up above in, like, the air ducts. And, of course, it just falls. And, or no, actually, rather... It doesn't fall.
The backdrop falls,
and Furuhashi's about to get knocked out by it when Yuega, I guess, leaps from the ceiling to protect her.
He's wearing the cat costume now, so he's nimble like a cat, Chris.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, he's not a klutz or anything anymore. Because that seems like an amazing feat to, and also impossible when you think about, like, the physics of it. Like, if it's falling down and he's already higher, how does he swoop in beneath? You know what? Fine, he has a jetpack. He saves Furuhashi, and Furuhashi says, like, ooh, I have an opportunity. So she's like, just go with me on this, and kisses him. And that's how we end the chapter, with her kissing him. Although, obviously, he's still wearing the giant fucking Meowpolian costume, so it's not a real kiss, because she kissed him on the helmet.
It's obviously, you know, even if she did kiss him directly over the mouth, it's a good way of handling it, because then it's like, okay, you get the kiss tease between Fumino and Yuega. They can both be embarrassed about it afterwards when the mask is off because she doesn't realize who it actually is. But they didn't actually directly kiss, so you don't ruin that moment for later. Mm-hmm. I also want to bring up, because it's not something that really got brought up, as I mentioned earlier, that, you know, Yuega had Asumi's guitar on his back, and he forgets to give it back to her. Like, she forgets to take it back from him when she goes to distract the teacher. So he still has it with him, and he realizes when he's up above the stage, like, oh, that's why I'm feel so weighed down. I forgot to give Senpai her guitar back. So he's still carrying the guitar with him at this point, which, you know, is not for no reason. So I'm curious to see, is like, well, what are they going to do with that then? Like, maybe there will be, like, a case of mistaken identity. Fumino will think that she kissed Asumi when she gets her guitar back. Maybe it'll be something that has to, like, involve the guitar for some other show or something like that.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. It's, yeah. You know, it's good they added this in to, I guess, fit all the girls in case people mm-hmm. were caring about that attitude whatsoever. But, you know, it's amusing enough, I suppose. The chapter really didn't do anything for me one way or the other. It's kind of just like, let's get to the end of this arc at this point, but...
I was I was really glad to see Asumi show up again, because it's like, oh, it's nice that you're here. Best character. So, all right, from there, let's move on then to The Promised Neverland, Chapter 91, All We've Got. So, we begin this chapter with a flashback from Luv's perspective, kind of getting the other end of some of the stuff that happened between he and Lucas and the geezer. And he basically, you know, just kind of reestablishes his motivations in more poetic terms, saying that humans seek happiness and hope, but it is ironic that despair is what cultivates them. Danger, extreme situations, it's only within despair that humans will agonize, think, rise, and evolve. Which is why he would allow people to live and escape. And he says, I've sowed many seeds, but not one of those seeds put forth buds easily. And among the people that he's lived are some of the kids that are actually in the compound right now. Anyway. So, but now he's basically gotten what he wanted. He's finally gotten his wish, you know, the exciting contest, the humans that I want to eat. So let's do this. And I never realized until he was wearing this hat with his face exposed, he actually looks a lot like Freddy Krueger, doesn't he? Especially with, like, the claws and stuff.
I'll take your word for it. I'm not on that page right now.
Okay. So, we get a bit of a flashback to the conversation that Emma was having with everyone earlier during their planning before Lou was barged into the building. She points out, why did the demon not regenerate his hands immediately when Nigel shot him? Shot right through his left hand, and it was a big, deep wound, but he left it alone up until right before he destroyed the house. So, she makes the conclusion that instead of their regeneration automatically, naturally happening, maybe it must be done by will, in which case there's a limit to it, because if he didn't do it right away, he saved it until he actually needed to regenerate his hand. So, they're like, okay, what we need to do then is just shoot him over and over again until he can't regenerate anymore.
Like, I mean, I guess that's a pretty good strategy. Like, if you just keep killing him, he can't come back, right? Like, logically.
It's a very straightforward means of, like, doing it, and I'm sure that there must be some sort of twist in this, because most of the chapter is just like, pour it on! like that scene in Predator where they shoot up the jungle. And it's just seems very unlike Promised Neverland to take that approach to things.
I mean, they do apply logic to it in the sense that they're like, you know, this is the strategy. There's limits as the weakness to what we've kind of identified with his power, with his regeneration. So let's exploit what we know and follow along with that. But
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and at one point as they're running and gunning, Ray kicks his table at Luvis.
That was like the weirdest shot where he's just like, hi,
I was parked on this table, now I'm kicking it at you. Ha, I'm so awesome.
Like, I'm just like, I really did expect there to be like a thought bubble like next to the head that was just like, hi-ya. like it's such a weird moment for him to just like prop up and start kicking the table.
So, just so weird. So we get that. Then we get, gunning and running and running and gunning. Emma kind of like thinking to herself while they're doing it. She, you know, is observing like, okay, his sight is coming back, but he still can't catch the bullets. As long as we're in these confined spaces indoors, we should be fine, because we have got plenty of bullets that we hid away for this fight. We got plenty of guns, so we just need to keep on attacking without hesitation, shooting bullets from places there. It doesn't make sense for the bullets to have been fired from. Did that bullet come out of my knee? That two-page spread with, like, the weird distortion effect, it looks so strange to me. And I swear, bullets came out of Emma's knee in that one panel.
It does kind of look like it.
So Luvis concludes, like, okay, it seems they've changed their strategy. They must have realized that they can actually, that there is a limit to my regeneration. So I better go outside now. He goes outside. The old man is perched on a roof again and shoots him as he emerges outside. So he's forced to make a run for it. They keep on shooting him as he makes a dash. But he's like, it's all right, though. You know, all of them are outside now, and the footsteps and bullets tell me which direction all four are in. Now is the time for my counteroffensive. Ah! What the fuck was that I just dodged? It's like part of a building. And he looks up, and it's Adam. Adam's come out, and he's reciting the number. I was like, huh, what are you doing here?
I'm like, I'm trying to process the notion of, like, Adam's there and what that essentially would mean. Because just, like, in my mind, I see his physique, and I'm like, he's like the Hulk. Bullets can't hurt him. He's already won. Luvis can do nothing to stop him. But I'm like, I guess he could. I guess, like, because Luvis is fast enough to stop bullets, he could just rip this guy to shreds. But
yeah, he can tear his throat out.
In my mind, it's a story of all, like, generally children fighting these guys. So, like, when you see one who's just like, duh, like, fight now, murder! Like, he's just reciting numbers and shit. Like, I don't know how to process how he'll play into this.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. And if you read the chapter through, it really does kind of feel like, we just need to shoot him a whole lot. Oh, he's getting ready to attack again. All of a sudden, this guy shows up, and that's like a twist. Because they didn't expect him to show up, I don't think. So this is the twist of things, and the thing that kind of, you know, throws a wrench into the proceedings of just how you think things are going to play out. And it feels weird for the Promised Neverland to do that. So I'm trying to figure out, like, what is actually going on here then? What is the hidden plan or something?
I don't know, honestly. I still don't really know what we're supposed to get out of the Adam character or anything that's kind of going on with this character right now. So I guess we'll kind of see. Like, obviously, it makes sense he show up. Mm-hmm. They made a big deal of the fact that he was gone that, you know, whatever, like a month or two ago. But I don't know. I don't have a beat on this character. I don't know if he's connected to Norman, if he's supposed to be like a sleeper agent. I don't know if he's supposed to be a good guy, if he's out of control, if this is Norman's doing. Like, I don't know how to place a beat on this character yet.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting wild card that makes me kind of, like, you'd like to think right now that he's there to help the heroes, because it's like, he fucks up Luvis, right? As Luvis is like, time to counteract these fools. And then he, like, throws a house at him, and he's just like, what the fuck? So, like, you'd assume that he's on the hero side because he interrupted the bad guy beginning his counterattack. But I don't, it's still tough to tell where this is going to, like, begin and not whatnot.
Yes.
All right, let's jump over then to the Seven Deadly Sins, chapter 272, Eternal Battle. So this chapter starts off with the Demon Lord kind of greeting the characters and talking about how, like, oh, it's worthless that you have come here. I don't know how you woke up, but, you know, you have been reverted back, and you being here means that you're trying to escape. But, you know, you know where the door is. And immediately, Wild's just like, let's get him! And fucking, like, runs straight for him with, like, his tusk attacks and everything like that. And the Demon Lord literally just fucking flicks him away.
I love that extra douchey touch. He could have done anything to attack him, and he specifically went...
It just sends him flying. And, like, you know, there at first, like, oh, no, Wild. And he's like, don't be distracted. I like how the pig is, like, the commando in the situation. He's like, get your head in the games. And there's this big sort of battle thing going on where the Demon Lord's basically like, you guys can't stop me. They try their different techniques on him, and he reverses all of them. Like, Bond tries to do his stealing technique, and he's like, what? He's actually reversing my power away from me? You know, Bond has to kind of save him. We see Wild trying a series of attacks. Literally, it looks like he's about to, like, spiral rip his way through the Demon Lord at one point, which, like, just looks tunnel awesome.
Through to the other side, yeah.
Like, he looks like he's about to, but then he literally just does basically the same thing again, where he catches it between his fingers and doesn't flick him, but he still basically just, like, fucking tosses him aside.
Go away.
And we even get a shot of Belodius trying full counter, but even that doesn't work. You know, he deflects the attack right back at him, but it doesn't work, and he even reabsorbed the magic instead. And, you know, Bond's like, what's this guy's magic made out of? Nothing's working on him. And Belodius says his magic is another name for his title as the Demon Lord, the Ruler. And we don't get any actual, like, technical explanation for what that power is. We can obviously make some presumptions based on the fact he countered everyone's ability, so he may just have the ability to go, nope. But He decides instead to say, like, you can keep fighting me and eventually disappear into dust, or give up and vanish from my sight. Either way, before you depart, Melodius, there's something you must hear. Earlier, you said you cannot bring to mind any memories about Estarossa, just as I cannot either. I, the great demon lord. I know it has been over 100 million years since I came to Purgatory, but I still remember vividly my days in the demon world. You know, talking about, like, you with you, Melodius, and Zeldris, and my minions, the Ten Commandments, and those the deplorable goddesses. And yet, I cannot remember Estarossa, and I am only aware that he is missing from my memories. Now has come the time to discern its nature. Come, speak what you remember of him. And Melodius basically gives the very simple explanation, like, I remember him.
Wikipedia summary, yeah.
Well, he gives also the version that we would not consider the connection to Estarossa at all. Like, oh, he was a coward who was born without the power of darkness and wouldn't even kill a fly.
And well, it's also the explanation that Estarossa gave about himself. Yes. When he thought that he was Meliodas.
And the demon lord finishes it by saying, and pitying his sad state, I gave Estarossa a commandment. And that's when they both kind of have a realization. The demon says, I knew it. It appears that everyone, myself included, who knows Estarossa are being led astray. That fiend must have done it. And he says, yeah, you know, Melodius is like, do you mean who I think you do? And he's like, yes, a traitor of the Ten Commandments just like you, Melodius. And we cut away to the group that's kind of flying away. And Hawk, I forgot his name for a moment. Hawk says, but why did you suddenly want to go after them in the first place, Galther? And we get the assumption then that Galther would obviously have a reason to play into this whole memory manipulation deal. To what ends? We don't know. But it is, certainly seems to be the implication there.
It's interesting, and now we are kind of getting like a full picture of like, well, this is why we've got this, you know, purgatory story going on right now in the actions, because it all ties in together with the Estarossa fight. So
I'll be curious to see how this actually like comes together, like what it ultimately means. Because again, like, unless Galther is removing something that would explain how Estarossa came from being somebody who wouldn't hurt a fly to being like the crazy super evil monster he is now. Or if it's something more complicated than that. I mean, I don't really know. It could be a lot of different things. But I am definitely intrigued to see where it is. It's unfortunate Galther seems to potentially be on the end of yet another, like, why would you do this? When he was finally just getting better. Yeah. But we shall see. Maybe there is a more noble insight from this that we are yet to see. Who knows?
Maybe he has nothing to do with it. Who knows?
Yeah, it could very easily be red herring as well.
All right. Let's go on to Black Clover.
Do you need me to recap Black Clover, Nick?
At least go through the popularity poll, because there is some interesting stuff to take note of here. So we get the Black Clover character popularity poll, which we've got Asta, then Yami, then Yuno, then Luck, the Wizard King, then which one is actually sixth? Fuego Leon. I thought that's an A for a second. Then Fuego Leon, Mario Leona, Gauche, Noel, and Nozel. Now, some of those I look at are just like, why?
People keep asking why Nozel, and I'm really confused as to why people are saying that. I was like, you guys read Bleach. You know Byakuya was like the exact same fucking character when ranked super high on popularity polls all the time, right? Like, that one's not a surprise to me whatsoever. Fuego Leon as six is a little surprising just because he hasn't been in the series for, what, like a year and a half now? But I guess maybe that's where the anime is getting to at this point, so maybe he's got something off of that. I don't really know.
I can only imagine that Black Clover is very popular with female readers. That's the implication that this character popularity poll gives me.
Oh, I thought that was pretty evident.
But then we get the English language poll results, which there are some very important differences in here. So you've got, you know, Yami and Asta and Yuno in the top four. Sneaking ahead of Yuno in order to be in the top three, though, is Noelle. So she's more popular among English speakers. Finral made the top five after being left out of the top 10 in Japan. Zora is number six. Good job, everyone. And then you've also got Mimosa and Charmy there in the top 10, too. So, there you go. Conclusive evidence and proof that English readers of Black Clover have better opinions than Japanese readers of Black Clover.
Sure. I mean, Rebecca didn't make the list one way or the other, so.
No, she's not an important character, Chris.
Hopefully everyone realized that. They're like, she's not important one way or the other.
But she left a lasting impact in her
three
appearances. I would have been very surprised if, like, you saw, like, what was his fucking name? The kid who is, was it Nash? I think was his name.
Oh, yeah, Nash, the kid from last week, the other week, yeah.
And a sudden surge of popularity after standing up for his family.
Everyone's just like, well, the father, obviously. Father, what's his name? He's my favorite character. He's been in the series since chapter one.
I'm just going to, like, you handle this.
All right.
Because otherwise, we're just going to be like, I told you.
I'm trying to actually see where the chapter title is.
The chapter title is on the
cover bonds. Page. Yeah, page 161, Human Bonds. So, Luck has gone super elf evil and is laughing to Vanessa and Magna about this, basically being like, want me to tell you why you can't win against me, how you could win against me? And Magna's just like, fuck you, I'll flatten you as many times as it takes until that bastard Luck wakes up. And he just says, your attacks will never hit me again. And he starts bouncing around and, like, lightning streaks flashing across the sky and everything like that. They realize he's basically a natural disaster right now. And Magna takes a look away, kind of distracted, and looks like there would be a fatal attack there, because we see a shot that basically looks like him ripping straight through it. But Rogue, I think, or is it Rouge? Is it Rogue?
Rouge.
Is it Rouge the Cat? Rouge the Cat. Same as Rouge the Bat. Fuck, that's gonna fuck with me now. I think it's Rogue the Bat. Anyway, Rouge uses its power to block the attack, and, you know, Elf Luck, or whatever we'd call the Not Luck, basically explains, like, ah.
He said his name at one point in the last couple of chapters, but who fucking cares? He's apparently not sticking around. He's gonna be the same as all these elf possessy people.
Not Luck basically explains, like, oh, so you control
bad luck.
He's like, you can control the future, but a power like that must burn through a lot of magic and, you know, human mages or magic from the elves who are beloved by mana. Which do you think is going to last longer? And I guess we time skip away to the point when basically he wins, because Vanessa is running out of magic. We see that Rouge is disappearing, like kind of unfurling like yarn. And, he, you know, Luck is holding Magna by the throat over a bunch of ruins. And he says, ah, so this is what you deserve, a fate we elves call down upon your heads. And Magna's basically talking back. He's like, shut up, you know, elf or not, I've got no business with you. That idiot is the one I want to fight with. So get up. So hurry up and get out of there, idiot. And Vanessa's like, yeah, he's my little brother, so give him back. And
I do like that. I do like that touch. Yeah. Like, oh, she really cares about him.
And Not Luck is just like, you humans turn traitors so easily. Are you saying you have some kind of bond? Don't make me laugh. Forget your lame bonds.
Kizuna.
Yeah. No matter what you do, you can't break the reincarnation spell. Only someone who's supremely awesome could just do that automatically.
Who's like so awesome and badass and cool and handsome and gets credit on every chapter that he doesn't appear in. Hang on, let me go check to make sure that Yuno actually showed up at the beginning of this chapter. I'm sure he did, but I have to make... Yeah, there he is!
He says, this human soul is already destroyed. And Magna counters by saying, oh yeah? Then why are you crying? And he basically starts screaming. He's like, hey, loser, while you're messing around, I went through some special training and got crazy strong. And if that burns you up, then wake up and fight me. And, you know, Vesna screams, like, you can't arbitrarily cut your ties with us. I'm not letting go. So hurry up and come back. And Not Luck just screams, shut up, human! And tries to gut him in the through the face with his lightning claws when Asta shows up. Because Rouge, with its last ounce of magic, basically extended its yarn far enough that Asta could latch onto it and drag him into the fight quickly enough to basically interrupt the attack and dodge it to the side. And Asta finishes up the chapter by saying, I bet you already know, and I'll say it as often as you want, though. We're Luck's friends! And that's the end of the chapter, Nick. Asta saved the day. Yeehaw. Hero.
Good for him.
Give your thoughts.
No.
Tell me how much you loved it. No? All right. I will say that for the like 80% of this chapter or whatever, that was really strong. I've mentioned before, I like that they're touching upon a relationship within the Black Bulls that has some kind of real tangential weight to it. Like, it isn't connected to just like the same like thing of shouting, I want to be the Wizard King. No, I'm going to be the Wizard King. That's it. Like, they actually have developed a Magna and Lux relationship to what we kind of know it. And giving a little bit for Vanessa as, like, the team older sister in a way kind of makes sense to close in there. Like, maybe she isn't necessary here, but they did give her a nice touch that makes her feel included.
It's a shame she doesn't have pants, but, you know.
Yeah, it is still weird. Like, I'm just like...
have this big dramatic moment while this girl is wearing a mantle and lingerie, and that's it.
I always forget that's supposed to be her character gimmick, that she gets drunk and half naked, but there we go. It is weird, though, because I have trouble telling what is meant to be the implication. Like, I hit on before that I'd be annoyed if they went with the idea that, like, all you need to do to wake these people up was to give them, like, hugs and friendship. But, I mean, there is some weight you could put to that, because it could lead to a cool moment like this where Magnus, the person who wakes Luck up and kind of goes to further the relationship those two characters have, that'd be super cool with. But it seems like they're doing that, but Luck can't wake up enough, so Asta's going to show up and he has the wind sword. He has the sword that they found. They're like, oh, this is the one sword that wins, which... Leash just gave up too, if I recall correctly. Like, I think it was like Rayo was just like,
I dropped it.
Don't you need that? And he's just like, no, the one thing that would unravel our entire plans? Why would I need that? Fuck you. So I don't know. It's a weird cross between the two of them. I feel like Asta's not needed in this. Like, if they went with the idea that Luck is able to be woken up just by the relationship he's forged with Magna and Vanessa, that would be fine enough as it is. It almost seems like the author's worried, maybe not like worried, but like there's just this pressure to be like, well, hold on, we can't have something develop without Asta or Yuno there. Like, we should make sure Yuno and Asta, or one of the two of them at least, is there to be involved. It's just sort of a strange thing to like push out there. I was like, I don't know if we're meant to get that, because it's just like there's a weird plot hole either way. If we're able to say like, no, you can't wake people up at all, and the sword's the only thing that does it, then it's like, so I guess Yuno is just that super special awesome that he's the only one that works with. And at the same time, you're like, if the sword is the only thing that's actually supposed to like pull people in, then why did Leash like seem super nonplussed about it disappearing? I don't know. It's a very kind of confusing state to be in, but I guess we'll see what next chapter actually comes around.
Okay.
I have no more analysis because I want to talk about One Piece. Like,
let's talk about One Piece.
Fuck yeah.
All right. Hang on. Let me just...
Nick, get on the phone, call work, and tell them you're not coming in tonight because we have 4 more hours of weekly manga recap to talk about.
No, we don't. Okay. So, One Piece chapter 908. The Reverie begins. We begin the chapter with Mancherry meeting Shirahoshi, using her tear powers to heal Shirahoshi's minor injuries from the little scuffle, and people who are gathered around them are kind of observing, like, oh, this is probably the meeting of the world's largest princess with the world's smallest princess. Then we get a little bit of discussion between them and Neptune and Leo and oh gosh, what's this guy's first name? What's this guy's first name? Shit.
Cool,
the world noble. The world noble from the Don Quixote family who saved their asses.
Just call him Don Quixote.
So Don Quixote is like... says, I'm glad that I could actually use the station I was born into in order to help you out. So, and so Leo says, hey, does this mean we can beat up anyone we want? And she's like, well, yeah. If it's to protect the princess and her companions. What? Just beating up someone else. I kind of really like Scrappy Doo Leo in a way. Fucking Pell shows up and I'm like, Jesus Christ, I forgot that character existed. It's been like 10 years since I've even read his name anywhere.
You should be glad that Chakum isn't there too.
Yeah, seriously, because I know that he's not the only person who was involved in the Alabasta arc that was very important for only that arc.
Fuck, I'm trying to remember. What was the name of the rebel leader? Kerr. Oh, fuck, it's going to bother me now. Carry on. I'm going to have to look this up. Alabasta characters.
All right. So, Bell mentions to Vivi that...
Koza! That was his name. Okay. Carry on.
Her father went with Admiral Fujitora to have a discussion with King Riku of Dressrosa. Which we don't really see. We see the actual reverie, the gathering of all the selected leaders later, but we don't see that meeting going on.
I'm sure we're going to at this point.
I'm sure.
We're getting like a glimpse of fucking everything.
We cut away to where Queen Dowager of Sorbet Kingdom Connie is being escorted around. It's this little old lady being escorted around. She's at the Celestial Dragon Gate, and they're like, I'm sorry, it's dangerous if you're here, so you should just return to the castle. But at that moment, St. Charlos is carried in on the back of fucking Kuma, which we're going to get to in a second here. His father?
Yeah, I believe it's his father.
St. Rosward. Comes in and is like, oh, Charlos, are you all right? I heard there was an incident, so I came to get you. He's the one who comes in the back of Kuma, because St. Charlos is just being attended to. And at seeing Kuma, suddenly the old lady runs off and scampers off. Oh, yes, they call St. Charlos' son. And he's like, oh, that Mjosgard, what a crank he is. I can't believe him. I can't believe that he's a celestial dragon who has no slaves. And between him and Howling, who left for the lower world 30 years ago, the entire Don Quixote clan is a mad bunch. And St. Charles is like, oh my gosh, you've got the invincible slave Kuma! Indeed I do! It's finally my turn on the rental list. This is so sad. They established that Kuma, because of his ability to not feel pain and his basic invincibility and the fact that he's been super ultra brainwashed, they just abuse him, take turns abusing him because they're sadistic fucking human beings. He's got all these swords sticking out of his body, he's covered in blood, and he's made to crawl around on his hands and knees carrying them around. Ugh. Information about Kuma, but go ahead.
I do like, there's times, and I, you know, I do want to at some point actually find what SBS it was. But there's times where I see a lot of people who sometimes really read deep into One Piece. And I'm always reminded of that time that somebody like messaged Oda and was just like, I loved Skypiea. I loved how you like took it as this interpretation of like this real life historical conflict that was like extremely intricate and deep. And like Oda's response is like, I just want to do Sky Pirates, bro. I'm not that deep. And like that's what my mind's looking at right now. I'm just like, I feel like this isn't a commentary on the current world. Oda just makes he was just like, I don't want anyone to like these guys.
Yeah. Kuma is actually specifically introduced because, you know, of course, we have the captions that say something descriptive about them, and he's like, Warlord of the Sea, former revolutionary officer and former king of Sorbet Kingdom. Kuma was once a king. And now he is a slave with no will of his own. That's... Ugh.
There is a tremendous amount of stuff to try to dissect through this chapter. I don't really know where to begin. I guess let's just mention the fact that the old queen turns out to be Jewelry Bonnie.
Mm-hmm.
And
worse, she's, of course, in disguise, and she's got some sort of past with Kuma, because when she sees him, she thinks, I made it inside, you'll pay, I swear it. While cutting between her and Kuma.
Well, It's worth noting that she doesn't have the ability to change her appearance as much as she could change how old she is.
Right.
And she's passing herself off as the queen of the Sorbet Kingdom, which is where Kuma was formerly the king. So potentially she could be Kuma's. It's weird because she has time aging power, so she could be Kuma's mother. She could be Kuma's wife or sister. She could even be a kid who ate the fruit, and she's actually a young girl, and she's Kuma's daughter or something like that. She has some connection with Kuma and, like, a familial relationship, it seems like.
Right. If she's able to pass herself off as Connie, if this is a real person connected with the Sorbet Kingdom,
yeah,
then Bonnie must have a connection with them. So
she could be anybody. Like, for all we know, she could be Connie herself, or she could just be, like, oh, a daughter who's aging herself up, or I don't know. The thing that's really interesting to me is the last time we saw Jewelry Bonnie, she was being arrested by the world government. And I guess it's because she's supposed to have some connection with the royal nobles that maybe she got out. But I'm curious to see what was the ramifications of that. Like, we found out that that was the case, but it's still interesting to see what was going to be the ramifications of that. Because, again, the last time we saw her, Blackbeard had defeated her and left her chained up on an island for a Khandu to find. So it's interesting to see her back there. And, yeah, I don't know. It's interesting to try to think what's going to be the situation that comes about here. Like, what's their relationship?
We then cut to below the ground, where Sabo is hiding out with the Revolutionary Army captains, or at least three of them. I don't know if I don't think that Betty is there. Sabo is infuriated to see Kuma being treated this way. He says, "Look what's being done to our comrade, to our kind-hearted Kuma." And everyone's trying to calm down. It's like, look, we're not going to just leave him like this. You know, this is the reason we're here. And Karasu says, "Is like, look, if we just break him out of bondage, that's not going to return him to the way that he was before." And what's the freaking inventor guy's name? I forget. Oh well.
Fuck, I forgot. I haven't.
He gives the biggest info dump. He says that he was the king of an allied nation. They used Kuma as an example. An example that even the hardest man will turn out like this.
Oh, Lindbergh. How could I forget that? Lindbergh.
And he says, the Celestial Dragons have CP0 Navy headquarters in their sights, so if we screw up and get caught, and Sabo says, we're not getting caught. We either succeed or we die. I feel like I like Sabo a little bit better after this small conversation, seeing him get this worked up over Kuma's situation, honestly.
Oh, I mean, I don't think Sabo's a bad character. I've always felt like he was just kind of superfluous, but it functions fine. Mm.
Then we get the reverie itself. We get some explanations like, okay, hey, here's a reminder. This is the way that the world is laid out, and this crossroads between the Grand Line and the Red Line is where they have this meeting, where there's this organization, the world government, made up of, over about 170 nations, and 50 chosen monarchs from those nations gather once every 4 years for a grand meeting, known also as the Reverie. And we get to see these people all gathering together, and you see, some that we're familiar with, like Wapol and Neptune and Prodence, who is trying very hard, well, not trying very hard, but coming very close to revealing that, oh yeah, he's friends with Straw Hat Luffy now. For those of you who don't remember, he was the one king in the Dressrosa arc who had the punch power anyway.
Yeah.
So everyone's gathered together. Apparently, the rotating chairman position is currently being held by Ballywood, the Abe Lincoln Uncle Sam guy.
No, that's Hamburg. He's the kingdom of the Bollywood Empire. Or the Bollywood
Sorry,
kingdom,
my mistake. Whatever.
I want Hamburger to be remembered as his name.
Also, Hitler is there. And Fu Manchu.
They were like, hold on, we haven't done every stereotype. See, so like super British dude with the long curly mustache and the Union Jack hat and everything like that. He's just like, chip, chip, cheerio. And there's
he
like this very.
Salutations, Chris.
And then this very, like, long, yeah, just a Fu Manchu. But then there's just outright Hitler at the table. It's just like, all right. Let's go with it. Let's see what this happens.
Meanwhile,
I hope they get to his name, and it's like Schmittler from the Nazi Empire. And I'm like, I don't get it. He had actual Nazis in the last arc. They were SS soldiers. Whatever.
Meanwhile, there's a conversation going on between the five secret leaders. The power behind the throne, basically. And they're like, the meeting has begun. And they say that Cobra, king of Alabasta, desires an audience with us. And they're like, the Nefertari dynasty, the sole bloodline of the first 20 to remain in the lower realm. In other words, they are traitors. So they're, kind of wondering what's going on with them. But one of them says, well, the world's equilibrium cannot be maintained forever. The time has come for a great cleansing. It's time for the purge, Chris! Lock up your home.
Oh, shit. I didn't realize it. Someone just pointed out the British dude's mustache is actually the hands of a clock. And I guess move like a clock would.
Oh, no, it's not his mustache, his beard.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what I mean, his chin, his beard, yeah. That is fucking great. He has Big Ben as his beard.
So then we see in the Chamber of Flowers, Pangaea Castle, someone addressed as Great Emu receives word that they have arrived. And the Great Emu is the shadowy figure in the long cloak that we saw enter the safe that had the large straw hat in it. Or at least they're dressed the same. So Emu has got a bunch of pictures with a sword stabbed through them. The ones that we see are pictures of what look like, it's clearly Blackbeard, clearly Luffy, and then I think that's supposed to be Shirahoshi on the top.
It is Shirahoshi. I know it's tough to tell, because you're like, which Nami is this?
Which Nami is this? But yeah, she's got the kind of ribbon thing going on with her hair. But he's holding on to a picture of Vivi, and as he ascends up to this, to the throne, the throne that no one is allowed to sit in, and then sits in it, he's addressed by the five, you know, secret leaders, the five elders who all kneel before him and say they pledge their service to him and ask, have you decided upon another light to be erased from history? Simply state the name you wish stricken. Man, Chris, Vivi's like the one person attending this river I didn't want anything bad to happen to.
Fuck, man. All right. So there's so much to unpack from all this. And it's crazy because we're getting like this new piece of the puzzle we haven't had before, like an actual figure behind everything. And it's crazy to think we know that the world government's been involved in these cover-ups, but now we have an actual figure here. And it's just kind of crazy to think of what the implications to all this is. You know, we've already, obviously we're not going to see what exactly that conversation between Shanks and the five elders was, because unless they were just like, he was like midway through, he's like, the pirate's name is like, oh, we gotta go. Like, put it on hold and they just left. I don't know. But like, you know, there's something to kind of pull from that. But this character we've never really known was a thing before shows up.
Yeah.
And we have this figure, and suddenly it puts a new element into One Piece's like trajectory going forward. I think one of the things I've always found kind of interesting is that One Piece has never been something that's like clearly established who the final opponent is going to be, despite giving us tons of options. Like, I've always been like, is it Blackbeard? Is it Buggy? Is it Shanks? Is it Akainu? Like, there's always been a ton of options for like who could end up being like the big final opponent for Luffy and the pirates and everything like that. And now it's like, oh, well, now there's Emu as well to add into this as like, or Emu rather, to add into this is like, oh, what's going to be the main antagonist here? Like, it's such a crazy thing. But then, like, the notion kind of pulling into it as well of, like, this is the person who chooses people to be wiped out from history. And you're trying to think, like, what qualification is he going after? Like, we see that he obviously has an eye out for Blackbeard, Luffy, and Shirahoshi. And Shirahoshi, as we noted, has, like, the power of a super weapon and her ability to communicate with Sea Kings. Why Vivi then? Like, what would make her so appealing as a target to be wiped away from history?
It seems to be people who have very strong influences over the way that the world is going. When you think about it, Shirahoshi is this person who, you know, is bringing this under, you know, the kingdom of the fishmen to the surface. That's going to change the entire world as a result of that. Luffy is the one making waves with a massive bounty on his head, getting involved with the different emperors. And of course, Blackbeard is this, has continued to amass power and go through from one influential position to another in the pirate world. So I think that it has more to do with the effect that Vivi is going to have on things than any specific ability that she might have, which is interesting because it might very well be connected to Cobra and whatever the hell Cobra was talking with Riku about and the meeting that he wanted to have.
There's definitely got to be something really kind of interesting to all this. I feel like we're about to find out something big about what Vivi kind of knows. We know that there was a polygraph there, but you know, you have to think, like, if the polygraph was the thing they're most concerned about, you'd think Luffy would be number one targets. It's the only person really who could still read pornographs is a member of his crew. So you'd assume that he'd be the biggest target. And as you mentioned, Blackbeard has been getting stronger and stronger with no signs of stopping, and also dreams about finding One Piece. So it seems like they'd be someone to watch out for too. Shirahoshi again seems like a big target. So Vivi has to do something big if he's like, no, fuck them. This bitch gotta go.
This is the linchpin. Yeah.
So it's crazy to think there. And again, like we know that Shanks showed up to have a conversation with the five elders about someone who had to be dealt with. What's going to happen from that? Like, I know we're going to come back to that at some point, find out what happens. I want to just know, I fucking love One Piece. I love this series because you're constantly rewarded for actually paying attention to shit and just enjoying the series and everything in it. Because at some point down the line, I know you're going to be fucking, like, I'm going to be rewarded for remembering that the fucking giant Saul from Robin's backstory was a member of the D family as well, and that'll eventually play into something. Like, I know that's gonna pay dividends at some point. And it's just like, I just love that this series keeps rewarding you for actually paying attention to stuff. There was so much that came from this chapter of just like questions that were posed from it, and I'm super excited just to see where it goes. Like, I don't know where we're going to be headed from here. I have no idea what is gonna happen to Vivi. Like, is she going to get a race of history? Because, like, there's not a ton of heroes here right now. There's revolutionaries, and I guess Shanks is in the immediate vicinity, but it's not like any of the Straw Hats are going to be here to intervene.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting if we actually have this, you know, side story arc go on with, yeah, none of them directly involved in any of it. So, all right, let's close things off then. Let's name our favorites for this week of manga. Chris, favorite chapter?
Oh, it's not even a question. It's One Piece. It's not okay. not even a choice. One Piece had so much this week.
I chose One Piece as well. I love all the different stuff that we got from it. It's the one that got me the most excited for the future. My MVP for this week is going to be Homura from Dr. Stone. I really loved seeing the bit that showed just how physically and mentally strong that she is. And, you know, I like getting that bit built up because she is the current antagonist that they've got to deal with.
I will give my character of the week to Endeavor. I thought this was a good, strong week for me to start caring about this character more, not just in terms of emotional depth, but also like mechanical depth. They've made like some kind of interesting developments with the way his powers work. I just think it's gone a good way into pushing the idea that Endeavor is going to be the number one character or number one hero. So giving him more dimensions helps a lot.
All right. And that is going to do it for Weekly Manga Recap this week. Guys, if you want to know what manga that we're currently working on to read, well, you have known already if you were part of the Discord server. There's a Weekly Manga Recap Discord server. Chris, do you want to share some details on that?
Yeah, you could check it out. It's still, I think, one of the most recent tweets on our Twitter, twitter.com/WMR podcast. And I'll try to include the link as well on episodes that go up, at least for a period of time. I'm probably going to eventually forget because I'm bad at everything. But you can get in there. There's tons of stuff in there. There's four threads to kind of talk about manga, talk about spoilers, talk about the current recommendation, which, in case you guys didn't hear, we didn't have one last week, but it was announced there first because as soon as I got from Nick, I updated it there. We're going to be talking about Strongest Legend Kurosawa. So we have threads there to talk about that. There's a My Hero Academia roleplay in there, if that's your jam. Tons of cool stuff, so go check it out if you're interested. Again, links will be in the Twitter and YouTube.
Yeah. And that's going to do it, everyone. Thank you for joining us this week for Weekly Manga Recap. We record the show on smashcast.tv/RoloT and twitch.tv/RoloT. Currently on Thursdays, beginning at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For further updates, you can follow us on Twitter. In addition to the WMR podcast account, there is RoloT and @NickFTime for your two hosts. Also, be sure to check out our past episodes on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Subscribe to us on YouTube. Leave a comment. Leave a rating. Help us out with the algorithm so that we can become kings of the hobby section and overthrow the woodworkers. If you want to send us any feedback, ask us questions for our Q&A episodes, or suggest future manga for us to read, like Strongest Legend Kurosawa, you can do all that stuff via email and send it to weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Or you can also join the Discord server. There is a whole section, a whole chat, just for making recommendations.
Absolutely.
Special thanks go out to our Patreon supporters. Your support allows us to create all sorts of fun bonus content for you guys to enjoy. We recently recorded new Digimon commentary. which I'm not sure if that's up yet or not.
It's not up yet. It will be coming up soon. But yeah,
we actually had to edit it together this time. So thanks, of course, to the people who help make this show what it is. Steve Manartakaris, you can check out his work in a number of different places, including his own Patreon and Infamous Planet. And that's going to do it, everyone. Thank you guys for joining us.
Yeah.
Now, let's get to work. Now that we've sorted out the Last Jedi remake, let's figure out the Terminator Genesis remake, because I think there's some stuff in there that could be fixed and improved.
I think we just do Salvation again.
I don't know.
But we spend more time on naked CGI Arnold Schwarzenegger. Like, honestly, there should be like seven of them in every scene. Like, they don't have to do anything. They're just in the background kind of interacting with things.
So we just get Arnold Schwarzenegger acting all roles in the movie. And we use CGI and makeup effects to make him appear all different ages and character types. So he'll we'll do T2. But we'll have Arnold Schwarzenegger on the back of a motorcycle driven by Arnold Schwarzenegger, chased by an Arnold Schwarzenegger in a truck.
Yeah, like, and they have like a pet dog, and it's just Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Bow wow.
Bow wow.
So it, of course, explains perfectly why the T-1000 is able to perfectly copy and mimic human beings. So it is a perfect likeness and sound alike.
There we go. We fixed that. All right. Fixed that series. Good job, us.
Give us millions of dollars, Hollywood. We'll make it for you.
All right. That's good. Do it.